You're listening to an RNIB Connect Radio podcast. A cultural journey with Toby Davey on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello, I'm Toby Davey and welcome to A Cultural Journey, bringing heritage to life through audio description for blind and partially sighted people here on RNIB Connect Radio as you join me for a tour of one of the world's most famous prehistoric monuments, Stonehenge in Wiltshire. What you're hearing in the background is a reimagined soundscape of the sounds and activities of the people shaping and moving the stones, capturing the human energy needed to complete the monumental task of constructing Stonehenge. During my tour with my wonderful English heritage guide, Stonehenge Deputy Operations Manager Scarlett Rolfe and Site Supervisor and Historian Liz Purvis, you will hear extracts from the recorded audio described guide to Stonehenge that can be pre-downloaded to your smartphone before your visit. And before you join me for my tour with Liz and Scarlett, here is part of the welcome introduction to Stonehenge from the recorded audio described guide.
A warm welcome to Stonehenge. Stonehenge is the world's most famous prehistoric monument, an ancient temple aligned with the movements of the sun. Your tour will tell you how and when it was built, who built it, and how the monument has changed through time. We'll also explore some fascinating theories about why it was built, and how it was used, and consider the surrounding landscape where many other prehistoric monuments were built. In fact, Stonehenge, and the area around it, is so rich in archaeological features that it's inscribed as a World Heritage Site. Built in stages between 3000 and 2200 BC, it's the only stone circle in the world to have lintels, the horizontal stones sitting on top of the uprights. Its architecture reveals the sophisticated minds and engineering ability of those who built it, the late Neolithic people of Britain. As you explore the monument, you'll not only find out about Stonehenge, but also the history of the area around it. Stonehenge stands within a landscape that includes prehistoric monuments and burial mounds dating from before, during, and after Stonehenge was built. While your visit will take you close to the stones, unfortunately you won't be entering the circle itself. That's because the archaeology below the grass is very fragile, and too much foot traffic causes erosion and damage. There are low ropes along the edges of the path that encircle Stonehenge. Please don't step over any of these ropes. With a history spanning 4,500 years, Stonehenge has many different meanings to people today. It is a wonder of the world, a spiritual place, and a source of inspiration.
You join me here on RNIB Connect Radio for a guided tour of what is perhaps the world's most famous prehistoric monument, Stonehenge, which lies at the heart of this World Heritage Site here in Wiltshire, which is managed by English Heritage. And my wonderful guides today from English Heritage is Scarlett Rolfe, who is the Deputy Operations Manager, and also Liz Purvis, who is the Site Supervisor and a bit of a historian as well, too. So, firstly, Liz and Scarlett, do tell me what it means to Stonehenge having this World Heritage status.
So it means an awful lot to us. We were inscribed as a World Heritage Site in 1986 alongside Avebury. So it's actually our 40th year of being a World Heritage Site, which obviously is incredibly important. It gives us World Heritage status. We're known around the world and make sure that we are kind of protected as a tourist destination, really.
And Scarlett, as Deputy Operations Manager, what do you actually do?
So working at a World Heritage Site as a Deputy Operations Manager is incredibly rewarding. You're not only trying to create a world-class visitor experience, but you're also helping to protect one of the world's most important prehistoric monuments. What many people don't actually realise is that English Heritage is a charity. So not only do we look after Stonehenge, but we also look after over 400 other sites across the whole of England, and all the funds that we make as a charity goes back into like a little pot that goes towards helping and maintaining and doing those conservation projects to preserve those sites for future generations to come. knowing that the work we do every day contributes towards the exceptional visitor experience and also the protection of Stonehenge, it makes it really rewarding. So that is my kind of job in a nutshell.
Well, before we sort of go on a little bit of a tour of Stonehenge, we're going to explore some of the models which give us a real sort of sense of how Stonehenge was developed and during stages of the development as well. So let's now just have a little bit explore of one of the first models.
There are four models of Stonehenge evenly spaced in a row. They are close together. Each one is on a waist-high circular plinth, sloping downwards and nearly a metre in diameter. Using small-scale 3D modelling, each one illustrates how we think Stonehenge appeared at three key dates and what it's like today. The models help to demonstrate that Stonehenge wasn't constructed all at once. People built, altered, and rearranged the monument over 1,000 years. We recommend you explore the models from left to right, beginning with the earliest monument.
So this model is based around what we think the site would have looked like around 3000 BC. So we have a henge enclosure, which is a bank and ditch feature. We're actually unique in the fact that we have our henge the wrong way round. It's meant to be a bank and then a ditch on the inside, whereas we have a ditch on the outside and a bank on the inside. So we're actually the wrong way round. It's 110 metres in diameter. And then on the inside of the bank, we have 56 post holes. So within those post holes, we're not sure whether they were originally wooden posts or whether they were the original settings of the bluestones. But when they've been excavated in the 1920s, they've had cremation remains found within them, along with chippings of bluestones, which is where that potential bluestone link comes in from there.
Okay, so if I put my hand forward, I can just...
There for you.
Oh, yeah.
There we go.
Okay, there's one stone. Is that the heel stone?
That is the heel stone.
Gosh,
yes.
I'm right.
Yes, fantastic. So the heel stone, we think, has already been on site. The rest of the stones have been brought here, which I'll cover in just a moment. But the heel stone is unique, and this is the one which the solstice alignment is based around.
And if I move my hand around, I can feel, yes, that ditch that she was talking about and the reason why it's in front of it. And
yes.
I can feel, oh, yes, there's some stones in the middle.
Yeah, so those are the post holes. So they're marked with a metal post for the model. But if you move your hand slightly further up, do you mind if I touch your hands?
That's fine. That's
lovely. Okay, yep. So we have... Just up here, we have a break in the henge.
Yes.
So this is called the southern entrance.
Okay.
So the original entrance is down by the heel stone. I'm just going to move your hand again. So there's the heel stone. And as I move you up, you can feel the gap in between. So that's the original kind of processional route, as we say. But we do have another entrance here on the southern side as well.
Okay. So people would have come... Either side, I suppose.
Yes, primarily we think approaching from the heel stone, because this is the most, when we get to the model, other side, is the most complete view of Stonehenge. When you get around to the southern side, when we go up to the stones later, it's a little bit rougher worked in that area.
Okay. And is there much more about this particular period or time? Is it, I suppose... This is very much the early stages.
Yes, this is very much phase one of the monument, as it were. So we have other monuments within the landscape. So we have something called the Cursus Monument, which is a long enclosure of a bank and ditch, which is 2.3 kilometres long, just to the northeast of the site, running to the eastern end. But that's in fields a little ways away from us. So you have the Cursus Monument, and then you have us here, at the site with our bank and ditch to start off with.
So this is obviously very much a sort of beginnings. And the next model, how far forward are we going to be moving?
So we're going to move forward 500 years into the future.
Oh, wow. Well, let's go. Okay,
fantastic. Right, we'll move slightly to your right.
Okay, I've got Boston up, that's so right. He's right.
Yep. Keep going. And now you're on to the second model.
Okay. Oh, yes. Oh, gosh.
So you can feel much of a difference. So there we go. You've got the hillstone there for you.
Yes.
Then if you move your hand slightly up,
yep.
You've then got our slaughter stone.
Oh, yes. We'll probably come to that later on.
You might still feel the henge around you. But then if you put your hand into the middle, a little bit more,
you can feel
the circle. So, this is when it was like basically like fully completed.
Okay. And that was 500 years later.
500 years after. So this is when the Sarsen stones were brought in. So the ones you're feeling now, that's the Sarsen stones. So that's from Marlborough and West Downs, around 20 miles away from here, roughly. So you can feel that's a completed
circle. So it was completed at that time?
They believe so, yes.
Wow.
Yes, and inside, you can feel that's the blue stones.
Okay.
So they're the smaller stones brought from the Pisidi Hills in South Wales, around 150 miles away from here.
Yep.
So you can feel those. So they're much smaller. So and compared to the Sarsen stones, these are about 35 tonnes, whereas the blue stones are between 5 to 8 tonnes.
Okay. And it's interesting because we have got the complete circle around it as well.
Yes.
Which is quite interesting because that's obviously not here now.
No. No, we'll move on to present day in just a little bit. You'll feel that, see that most of the stones have unfortunately either been taken or just, you know, within time.
Yeah. Okay, so this is 500 years from the first model. So where are we going next? What sort of time scale do we move to the next one?
So we're
one?
Moving on to 2200 BC.
So that's 300 years later.
Okay, so Boston, up you come. So, okay, yeah, I'm in front of the next one. And again, I find my heel stone at the bottom. It's my reference point.
Yes, so as you move your hand up, you'll come across the station stones again.
Yes.
And then if you move on further up, you'll reach the main circle. And now
it's quite far away.
It is. So there's about 150 metres between the heel stone and the main circle itself. So, but when you go inside and feel the blue stones again, you might notice they're in a different shape compared to what they were in the model we've just looked at. So about 200, 300 years later, after they did the initial build, they decided to move the blue stones. So instead of being in two concentric circles, which they were on this previous model, they're now on one circle, and then they come inside the Sarsen horseshoe itself and create a bluestone horseshoe.
And was that just, I suppose, evolution and development, or was there a purpose, or do we not know?
We have absolutely no idea. Obviously, there's going to be quite a few generations in between the first phase and the second phase that we have. So maybe times have changed, they've had new ideas come in. You know, the original builder, whoever it was who came up with that idea, or whether it was a community-led idea, has obviously kind of changed and migrated to what the community needed then, perhaps.
Yeah, and we've still got the as a feeling round it, the complete circle around it as well. So that was still there. So, okay.
Yes.
Okay. And we've obviously would have, the
So we've got
the henge around it as well.
Absolutely. Now, what you just touched upon, actually, I'm just going to move your hand slightly further up again.
Oh, yes,
this is one of the station stones. So they have four of them. And the centre of the rectangle that they make is also the centre of the circle. So it's thought that they were put up to help possibly negotiate the building of the circle. But recent research, which is actually still ongoing, suggests that they also have a lunar alignment with the most northerly major moon rise and moon set, which happens every 18.6 years. So we've just had a phase during 2004-2005, which folks from Bournemouth University, I believe, were looking at. So the research paper hasn't yet come out, so it's not confirmed.
Oh, wow.
But yes, there's certainly a lunar element to the site as well as the solar.
Okay, because I suppose that ties in with, you know, summer solstice and winter solstice, and also the movement of the moon as well. Because it's not just the sun, it's the moon that has an effect on the world as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, well, how far are we going to jump to the present day?
Present day. Present day now. So you'll feel the models feel...
Okay, if I come along a bit. Oh,
This one's going to discombobulate you because we don't have a heel stone on this model.
Oh, my goodness. Why? My point of reference is gone.
I know. I apologise. So we've supersized the circle, the main stone circle, as it were. So at the moment, you're feeling what is left of...
Ah, yes. Yes.
At the circle that goes round. So this bit here... Okay, this is the only remaining section still left. So if you move to the right-hand side across... Yeah.
Oh, yes, I can feel it. Yes,
so
yes.
It's present day, we still have that. Then if you move a little bit further round...
To my left or right, sorry.
To your right.
Yep, yep. That's a good another gap. Yes. Yeah.
You'll feel. So if you don't mind moving your hand up here.
Oh, yes.
You'll feel the sections, missing. The stones missing.
Yeah.
And that's because over time that was either taken for building material.
Yes.
Or, you know, deconstruction for the last, you know, couple of hundred years.
Well, once the stones, so quite a lot of the stones have fallen. So I'm just going to move your hand again to show you a fallen stone. So this is one of the horseshoes, one of the trilithons in the horseshoes. And as you can see, it's broken up into smaller pieces.
Okay.
So these three here are actually, it's lintel.
So that's fallen off.
Yes, that's fallen off.
Yes, that would have originally been at the top to make the horseshoe shape.
Oh, wow. Gosh.
So, yes. And you can feel how small the pieces they've broken into.
Yeah,
and
tiny.
And as soon as you've got horse and cart, and you've got a quarry, essentially.
Yes.
So they've probably gone off into the local landscape, foundations of houses, bridges, so on and so forth.
Do you see that? I mean, around here, can people say, that's a bit of Stonehenge in somebody's ward?
So one of the kind of local legends, I'm not sure on how true this is, so... but one of the manor houses in Lake, which is a local village to us, apparently has blue stones in its garden.
Yes.
I've never been to the house. I cannot confirm it, but it's kind of a local myth that this manor house has got some Preseli blue stone in it. And obviously it comes from quite a distance away. So it would have been a lot of trouble to bring it here. But
that's it's probably quite a few houses in Amesbury in the local area that has sarsen and bluestone without even realising built in.
We are now going to actually walk outside, and you do have some replicas of the blue and Saracen stones, which we can feel. So shall we go over there next?
Of course.
A cultural journey on RNIB Connect Radio.
Side by side are two types of stone used to build the stone circle at Stonehenge in about 2500 BC. The taller stone, around 1.5 metres in height, is a natural sample of rough, rust-coloured sarsen, a hard sandstone. Next to it is the smaller, pale grey, smoother blue stone, a spotted dolerite, a volcanic rock. Both types of stone were brought over long distances to Stonehenge. People used sledges and ropes to haul the stones, perhaps using rollers over land and simple boats along rivers and the coast. The blue stones are from the Preseli Hills in southwest Wales, around 240 kilometres away. The sarsens, some weighing more than 30 tonnes, were probably brought from the Marlborough Downs around 24 kilometres away, north of Stonehenge. All visitors are welcome to touch and explore this bluestone and sarsen stone.
So we've now moved outside, and in front of me is one of the standing stones. And I think, is that a sarsen stone or a bluestone?
It's a sarsen stone.
Okay, and it feels quite rough as well. Because I think some stones were sort of carved and smooth whilst others were left rough. Is that correct?
Yes, so this stone is an example of a rough sarsen. But we think the stones, when they were put up in the circle, would have been worked so that they were as smooth as they could possibly be. This example is from the Marlborough Downs, so not quite the same as the sarsens that we have in the circle, which came from West Woods, but they're still very geographically close. But this stone, it's got a lovely reddish-brown hue to it, which is due to the iron ore content that we have in this stone. So there's a very clear difference, colour differentiation between the two stones. The sarsens are kind of a pale pinky grey, but they can change depending on how much of their iron ore elements they've got in them. So this is actually quite a dark example of the stones. When we go up to the circle later, they look quite grey there. But obviously this has the benefit of being worked smooth by lots of hands touching it over the years. So it's a very smooth example. Whereas if you were, you know, up at the solstice event and able to go near the stones, you could see that they were a lot rougher in person.
And this is obviously a true replica of size of the stone, isn't it?
It's a slightly smaller example in terms of our sarsen stones. So this is pretty much actually head height with you. So the top of the stone is the kind of the top of your head, to be honest. So 5'7", 5'8", perhaps. So this is a significantly smaller stone. Our tallest stone at the site is actually 7 metres high.
Wow. So
this is just a little baby that has been sent to us to exhibit up here at a visitor centre.
And it's quite interesting to think, you know, these stones, as you mentioned, weigh, you know, sort of 3 tons, 5 tons-ish or whatever. And it's quite a hefty thing to move around. And they were quite ingenious, the Neolithic people, in actually, you know, sort of moving the stones from Wales and from Marlborough to here. I mean, it was quite incredible how they actually got them here in the first place.
Yes, it's incredible. So just behind us, actually, we have a fiberglass replica of one of our full-size stones, which is on a wooden sled with logs underneath it. So we think that essentially for the Sarsens, they would have been put on a sled with ropes, which you can make out of cordage that was available at the time, and then pulled along using logs underneath it as kind of wheels, essentially. They didn't have wheels at the time, but they had round logs, which would have eventually got there. And actually, we did an experiment in February 2018, which was a 5-ton block of limestone. And actually, it was a class of year three, so what are they, 6, 7 years old, something like that. They, a class of 30, could pull a 5-ton block of limestone on fairly flat ground, but they could absolutely do it. So if you're supersizing that with, you know, adults, you've absolutely got the pulling power to pull one of those stones from Westwoods, which is incredible.
That's incredible to think that, you know, a bunch of school children could move them with the logs as well. That's quite incredible.
Yeah, it was phenomenal. They had great fun doing it as well. It was a very different school trip for them.
And I suppose also it's interesting to think how, you know, sort of the way wood was put together, how they used that in stone as well, you know, sort of the mortar joints and that kind of thing, I think, was very much used here.
Yes, absolutely. So we have clear examples of woodworking techniques being used in stone with the mortise and tenon joints. So Neolithic Lego, essentially, is what we have here, as well as the tongue and groove to secure the lintels to each other. And those are still techniques that you'll find in woodworking today. So they've just transplanted their knowledge from one material to another.
And it's interesting to think about the numbers of people who were here working on Stonehenge during the time. I think there was like 4,000 people from Neolithic time who were working here. Is that right?
Yes. So at Durrington Walls, which is where they were living at the time they were building Stonehenge, we actually have some replicas just to the just in front of us here of the houses that they were living in at the time. And we think it was quite a short-lived community, about 50 to 100 years that they were based at Durrington Walls. But it was certainly a large community effort to bring people here and erect the structure, because obviously you had to have people coming from Wales. We now know as well that we also have a stone that's come down from Scotland, which is our altar stone, and research that came out last September kind of pinpoints it to northeast Scotland, so not quite up towards Orkney, which would have been amazing with the Scarra Bray link. Unfortunately, we don't have that, but certainly to have a stone from Scotland is incredible.
It's interesting to think that, you know, because we know about the stones coming from Wales, and we think of how they came over here and, you know, getting across maybe the River Severn and stuff and things like that. Yeah. But to come from Scotland is quite incredible.
Yeah, it's absolutely phenomenal. I mean, they've got to get through the Lake District, Peak District, God knows everything. And that's if they came over land. If they came through sea, obviously the North Sea, round the tip of Kent, and then, gosh, I presume up the river. Oh, gosh, what's the river that goes into Southampton? I can't remember. Itchen?
Yes, I think it's the Itchen. Yes, you think you're right.
Yes, Itchen, and then obviously using the waterways up here if they then didn't make land and go from there. But the possibilities of the routes are absolutely endless, and let alone, you know, if you're only taking this one stone with you, you're going to want to make sure it survives the journey. So you're going to want to do the safest route possible, which possibly the North Sea is not the safest route.
But it's quite nice because it shows you all the different communities that came together. You've got Wiltshire, you've got the community in Wales, Scotland. So it just shows you how important Stonehenge was and why did it come from different parts of the UK.
I suppose that's something we don't necessarily know.
No, we don't. No, exactly.
No, all the folklore of this place has sadly been lost. Any oral history that we had has just been lost through time, which is incredibly sad. So Stonehenge will always be a place of mysteries. And I think personally, I'd be very sad if they solved every single one. So, because it gives people something to talk about and engage with when they come up here. Yeah.
So I've just moved from the Sarsen stone to a blue stone. Scarlett, this feels a lot rougher to me in many ways.
Yes, so the blue stone is a
volcanic rock.
So from the Presidi Hills in South Wales. So as you can feel, it does feel rough on the surface, but there's actually little dots all around it, some like white markings. And this is, again, a theory of the more white there is in a blue stone, the more healing power it can have. So again, it's one of the theories of what the white represents in our blue stone. But our blue stones are much smaller than the sarsen stone. Most of them inside the circle are around my height, which is about 5'3", roughly. And we have some smaller ones that are fallen as well.
Yes, I say the tallest blue stone is probably around 6 foot two-ish. They're significantly smaller than the sarsens. This blue stone is kind of coming up to mid-chest level on you, just so you know. But yeah, so this is a spotted dolerite, which is why it's got the quartz inclusions. So think of kind of a dark Dalmatian, but with white spots, not black, as it were, a reverse Dalmatian. And you've got our blue stones. But they are a gorgeous polished dark blue when they are kind of polished and worked, so that would have contrasted really nicely with the greyer sarsens.
That's incredible. Well, let's have a look at a Neolithic house.
Each of these four houses is just under 5 meters square, with rounded corners, and their rough white walls covered with cob, a mixture of chalk and water, are topped with a sloping thatched roof. These houses are reconstructions based on evidence uncovered by archaeologists at Durrington Walls in 2006. They were occupied in about 2500 BC, just when the stone circle at Stonehenge was being built. It's where the people who built Stonehenge may have lived. Finding evidence of houses from this period in Britain is rare, so this was an exciting discovery. In one of the houses, archaeologists even found depressions in the floor where the occupants knelt to tend the fire. Outside the houses, they discovered large pits filled with discarded animal bones and pottery. Some still had meat attached when they were buried, suggesting that people gathered at Durrington Walls for ceremonial feasts, particularly in midwinter.
Okay, well, we're now inside one of the Neolithic houses. And how many people would have been in here, living in here, during the time of the building of Stonehenge, do you think?
So we think possibly a family of 10 could have fitted quite comfortably inside this space.
And would it have been a family as well as a sort of animals and things like that as well?
Animals we think they kept outside, possibly in cases of bad weather they might have brought them inside. But when they've looked at archaeological findings, they haven't found large evidence of animal activity within the houses themselves. It's been very much a household area.
And there were quite a few, weren't there, in Durrington Walls as well?
Yes, so we think approximately 1,000 houses within the Durrington Walls enclosure. It's a very big enclosure, so it certainly would have had the capacity to fit a large amount of houses inside it.
It does feel quite roomy in here.
Yeah, it does, yes. So on each side, we have got replica bed pallets made up.
Would they have had a fire in here to keep themselves warm and to cook?
Yes, they would have. So next to us, there's a little marking on the floor that shows you where they would have put a fire. And the fire would have been lit inside and the smoke would have evaporated through the roof itself, but it would have also acted as an insect repeller as well, so to avoid the insects getting in. So the fire would have been there and they would have done their cooking and
pottery making.
They would have been sat round here together as well.
So quite homely and quite nice.
Yes, you'll see these like patterns on the wall. Again, like how you decorate your house at home, you want to make it nice and pretty. So that's kind of their marking to decorate the walls of the houses as well.
A cultural journey on RNIB Connect Radio. The large, irregularly shaped, leaning grey stone close to the path is called the heel stone. It's around 2 metres in height and almost 3 metres wide at its base, tapering slightly to the top, and leans towards the monument at 45 degrees. It looks natural, rough and pitted, with patches of lichen. Like all the large stones, it's a type of stone called sarsen. But unlike the stones in the circle, it hasn't been shaped and remains in its natural state.
It may have been found here before people set it upright. There are raised parallel banks and ditches on either side of the Healstone. They form a corridor running towards Stonehenge about 20 metres wide. This is called the Avenue. The Avenue is nearly 3 kilometres long, linking Stonehenge to the banks of the River Avon. The Avenue was probably built in about 2300 BC, after the stones were raised, and may have been some form of processional routeway. The people who constructed Stonehenge aligned the earthwork entrance and later the Avenue with the movements of the sun. If you were standing inside the stone circle on Midsummer's Day, you'd experience the sunrise over the Healstone in this direction. Similarly, if you were standing here on Midwinter's Day, you'd experience the sunset in the opposite direction. The setting sun would have been framed between the two uprights of the tallest trilithon on the far side of the stone circle. Stonehenge's alignment shows that its builders had sophisticated understanding of the sky. The seasons would have been very important to them. The winter would have been a difficult time. They needed the return of longer days and warmth to grow their crops and feed their animals. Perhaps Stonehenge was a sort of calendar, or a place where the seasons were celebrated. We think people may have gathered here at midwinter and midsummer to celebrate and conduct rituals.
So we have now taken a little trip from the visitor centre on the bus to Stonehenge, and we're in front of the Healstone, which is quite incredible because it's roped off, but it is not too far away from me. And just put us into place where we are, Liz, sort of in the Healstone's in front of us. And the stones are in front of us, but the avenue is behind us. Is that right?
It is, yes. So the main bulk of the avenue stretches down into the dip, which is called Stonehenge Bottom. It's a dry riverbed. It then takes a dogleg elbow up to the ridgeline, where we have some later Bronze Age barrows upon it. And then eventually it makes its way down to West Amesbury, where it will go into the and meet the River Avon.
And this is obviously very significant, because this is the stone that when the sun rises on the solstice, that's where the sun comes up. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. So June 21st, we have our solstice event. So we were joined by 22,000 people this year. So it was incredibly busy. And we all watched the sunrise over the Healstone. And it was met with cheers and, you know, an absolutely incredible atmosphere, really.
And it's incredible to think what else is around us, because this is, you know, a World Heritage Site. It's Stonehenge, but it's also the land around us. And you were mentioning the boroughs which are around us, which were, I think, burial mounds, weren't they? Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. So within just the Stonehenge part of the landscape, we have over 300 Bronze Age burial mounds, some of which have been excavated, some of which haven't been. But the grave goods from those that have been excavated are either in Salisbury Museum or Wiltshire Museum in Devizes. And Wiltshire Museum actually has the bush barrow gold. So we think it was a chieftain, or at least a very high-ranking Bronze Age person, and he was buried with an incredible amount of gold-worked decorative jewellery. It's absolutely phenomenal. But it's, yes, beautiful.
And I suppose, Scarlett, there was also the archer who was found, I suppose, not too far away in one of the sort of henge ditches.
Yes, so as you're looking, so at the minute we are looking out to the processional route into Stonehenge. But on the right-hand side, that is where the archer was discovered, buried in the henge. And he was found with an arrow going through his back. So it was three arrows going through his back. So that is where he was buried. And next, just across from it, you've got the slaughter stone. So a lot of people kind of believed he was slaughtered there, but that's no evidence about that whatsoever. The slaughter stone is actually a Sarsen stone, and we believed at one time it was fully standing, but the reason they call it the slaughter stone is from the Victorians, because when it rains, it's like the iron in the stone makes the water turn red. So there's no link between the slaughter stone and the archer. People believe there is, but yes, the archer was buried in the henge and was discovered there.
And he, I think they said he was about 30 years old, so sort of fairly young in many ways.
Yes, he was around 30 years old.
Yeah, 30 to 35, yeah. I believe. So he is now in Salisbury Museum. So he is laid out in position there. He was actually discovered completely by chance. No one knew he was there. We had a scientist who was actually doing a snail study up here, and he was excavating in the ditch and suddenly came across, a leg bone, and obviously was like, well, this isn't a snail. And obviously kind of it went from there. So it was an absolute fluke that he was discovered, really.
And I suppose, how significant is it? Because does it sort of, I suppose, state or indicate to us that, you know, the type of person who was around at that period?
Yes, so he was from the Bronze Age period, so about 1500 years after the main activity at Stonehenge had ceased. So it shows that we were still paying attention in this landscape to this structure, and that they were still burying people here who were of high importance. So anyone who's got any kind of metalworking skill at that point is going to be incredibly important to the community, because it's such a vital skill to suddenly go from stone to having bronze axes. Your workload is, you know, halved, you know, even so easily from chopping down woods and everything like that. And just being able to make those tools would have been phenomenal for the community.
And I suppose, does he sort of date back to the time of when the stones were being moved here, or was he a little bit further ahead?
Oh, he's much later. So once the main structure has been completed, he's about 1500 years after that. So, gosh, 1500 BC?
Yeah.
As a rough date off the top of my head.
And that's quite interesting because, you know, as you say, you know, instead of using sort of stones and flints and things like that to sort of shape the stones, you know, it's very much of that age of using metal and stuff. But that just makes you think how incredible it was that Stonehenge was built and how they built it. Because I think they, you know, to raise the stones and put them in where they wanted them, they used to dig sort of holes in the ground, and that would use ropes and pulleys to lift the stones up.
Yes, absolutely. Yes, there would have been kind of an A-frame system created to pull the stones into place. But it's really interesting because when you look at the archaeological reports that have happened, there's a very straight line which the stone kind of butts up against. And then there's a slope, which is what they would have used to kind of rest the stone on before pulling it upright. That is then backfilled with their own stones that they use to shape it into place. So when you look into the exhibition, in one of our cases, we actually have examples of those hammer stones. They might be called maul stones, which were excavated. And were used to help support the stones as a foundation.
How much was the sort of, I think, healing part of Stonehenge? Because there is a connection, isn't there?
Yes, so Professor Tim Darvill, who has sadly passed, he first made the connection with the blue stones as being a healing power. And actually with the quartz, the spotted dolerite in there, quartz in crystal healing is an amplifier. So you've definitely got a connection there. And I think it's just, they're a very calming stone to be around. I've had the privilege of working here 10 years, and every time I get to go inside the circle, the energy shift in there is so different, and it can be so calming. We can have, you know, thousands of visitors here every day, and being able to go into the stones at the end of the day to do our kind of end of day checks. But it's just, the atmosphere shift is just, it's incredibly peaceful. So yes, I would say they've got very interesting properties to them. Obviously, we get folks from all around the world who very much believe in the healing properties of the blue stones, and those who know it's a bucket list photo opportunity. So Stonehenge can very much be interpreted in any which way. But yes, Professor Tim Darvill, he's the chap to look up for his healing theory.
Originally, there were four station stones, marking the corners of a rectangle, but only two stand today. If you were to draw a line between opposite corners of this rectangle, they would meet at the exact centre of Stonehenge. The station stones were probably put in place around the same time as the Sarsens, around 2500 BC. Their meaning is still a mystery. They may have served as survey markers for Stonehenge's original builders, or they may have marked particular phases and movements of the moon at various times during the year.
Well, we've now moved a little bit further along from the Healstone and we're in front of one of the station stones, which we explored through the model earlier on. Liz, just tell me a little bit about what they actually represent, because it's to do with Luna, it's to do with, the stars and everything else.
Yes, so the station stones, so on our models, we show them as a complete rectangle. Up here at the site itself, we've only got two out of the four remaining. So the lunar alignment, bless them, when they were doing the research, they actually marked where the station stone used to be with a handbag, I believe. They are looking into the lunar rather than the solar side of Stonehenge, and it's the most northerly moonrise and moonset and the most southerly moonrise and moonset. So this is something that happens every 18.6 years, so it's an incredibly rare phenomenon, but at that time the Neolithic people would have been watching the skies to see what was coming next, essentially. So they would have had such a grasp of the kind of stars at that time, and kind of could foretell what was happening, perhaps.
And I suppose that's the thing, because we sort of use the stars for navigation and everything else, and I suppose around the time of Stonehenge it was very much more to do with, I suppose, feeling or healing, or it was to do with way of life rather than sort of navigation as we use them now.
Yes, very much so. I mean, navigation, obviously the North Star would have been paramount to them as much as anything else. I mean, especially if you're covering long distances such as our stones were, knowing where you were within your landscape would have been absolutely key. So whether that was through, actual visual landmarks when they were travelling during daytime, but even at night, knowing where certain stars should be would have been really key for them.
And it's quite interesting because, as you say, there's only, I think, two that are actually here. So we can actually sort of get a sense of, sort of how important they were. But it's also, it's interesting to be here standing in front of them and thinking about, the scale of it. Because I think that's the thing which really sort of hits me whilst I'm standing here. I felt the models, I can get a sense of the location and the size and how things are placed. But actually to be standing in front of them just adds that much more to it.
Yes, absolutely. So this station stone is recumbent. We think originally it would have been upright, but it has fallen since. So if where we're standing right next to it, it's kind of coming up to our knee level, as it were. So to compare to the heel stone, which was towering above our heads, we've now gone down to a very small stone, but no less important for it.
Let's move on, and I think we're next going to chat about Aubrey, who was one of the archaeologists who discovered many sort of, I suppose, areas and elements of Stonehenge.
A cultural journey on RNIB Connect Radio.
Well, we have just moved a little bit further along on our little tour of Stonehenge, and I'm actually standing on one of the Aubrey holes. Liz, tell me a little bit about Aubrey, because I think he was not the only archaeologist, but one of the first archaeologists who dug holes and discovered a lot about Stonehenge.
Yes, absolutely. So the Aubrey holes are so-called because of John Aubrey. So in his reports, he noticed five depressions just on the inside of the henge. He didn't excavate them at the time, but he made a note in his reports, which is so key for a place like Stonehenge so that we can track its history through the ages. And it wasn't until the 1920s when an archaeologist called William Gowland, who was working on the site, actually started excavating those holes. Now, at the bottom of them, he found cremation remains, which were kind of evenly split between both male and female occupants. There was about 150 remains that were found when he was excavating the now called Aubrey holes. Not all of them have been excavated, but all of them have been marked with a little concrete marker. But our visitor path goes over the top of one of them, so that's just marked with a plain silver ring instead, so it doesn't pose a trip hazard.
Won't fall down the hole, yes.
Absolutely. So it's a ring of 56, and the southeastern and eastern side are the ones that have been excavated. And actually, when they were looking at isotope analysis, because they managed to find some teeth in there, some of those individuals were coming from Wales. Now, considering the blue stones are also Welsh, it's a really lovely thought that perhaps that they are the people who are bringing the blue stones to us, and they were decided to be, commemorated in this space.
That's quite incredible to think that, isn't it? Like the people who actually worked and built Stonehenge were buried here as well. And there's that split of male and female. So it wasn't just male men building Stonehenge. There were women here as well who, you know, in our mind today might have been, you know, sort of the women supporting the men. But I suspect it was probably both.
Yes, very much so. And also children would have played their part as well. Obviously, they don't have iPads to occupy them back in the day. But they would have still been given tasks of maybe making rope to pull the stones here. You know, looking after the fires at Durrington Wall. Maybe catching small animals such as, not rabbits, because they didn't have rabbits at the time. They came over with the Normans. But, you know, the local wildlife that they would have had, you know, possibly the children would have been responsible for catching that instead.
And this is a nice sort of way to sort of, I suppose, in a way, not quite almost end our tour, but almost end our tour in a way, thinking about the people. Because I think, you know, we can look and we can see Stonehenge, we can see it from the A303 as you drive past. But actually thinking about the people who worked here, people who lived here, the families and everything else just brings it a little bit more to life for us, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And when you think of the sheer amount of human effort that went into building here, went into building Durrington Walls, which obviously you can see the replica of the houses, there was such human effort that was put into this place. So, you know, when people say, oh, it's just aliens, and I'm like, no, it's not. It's very much a human endeavour at the time when we were living with very limited technology, as it were, and they were creating absolutely beautiful masterpieces which have really stood the test of time. And it's just, oh, it's incredible. I love it.
What does it mean to you both, having people coming to visit Stonehenge? There's lots of people walking around us at the moment on their tours. What does it mean to you both? And maybe to you, Scarlett, first.
I think it's beautiful, the fact that Stonehenge can bring so many different people from all over the world to come here and celebrate different, you know, religions, different interests. And it's just such a place for the people. Whoever comes here, all the tours we see, we want everyone to walk away to think, wow, that was amazing. We really hope we brought back the history to life for those visitors.
And Liz?
Yes, so the human element here, I think, is really key. The fact that you could still imagine yourself here 5,000 years ago, you know, possibly being working on the monument yourself, because these are, you know, our ancestors. They're not Neanderthals. They are humans who are living and working in this landscape. You know, as much as, you know, the staff do nowadays, you know, we put up with the same weather conditions as they would have done. You know, people coming to visit, as obviously they did at Durrington Walls. We've got evidence of feasting happening pretty much every winter solstice in that space. And they were bringing cattle down from Scotland from isotope analysis. So, you know, they were having communities visit them, you know, 5,000 years ago. And it's just become a much larger tradition here. And it's not just the stones that people want to see. They want to engage with the entire landscape around us, from the Bronze Age barrows to the Cursus monuments to further afield, such as Avebury. You know, we are all connected, and it's a beautiful, beautiful landscape to be connected with.
Well, to end my tour of Stonehenge, I'm actually standing inside the circle of stones, and it's just magical to be here around the stones, actually having them very close and getting a feel and a sense of them around me, and it is a magical experience. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to say that again. It is very magical to be here, and it's a wonderful way to end this tour, because I've been driven past Stonehenge on the A303 many times to Somerset and Devon, and looked to my right or to my left, and when I could see a little bit more, I could see the stones. But to be here inside the actual circle with them around me is, as I say, absolutely magical and a wonderful way to end my tour. And thank you very much indeed, Liz and Scarlett, for taking me around Stonehenge today.
You're very welcome.
What a privilege it was to be able to be there amongst the stones. And I must thank Liz and Scarlett for an amazing tour of Stonehenge and a great insight into the history of the site too. If you have an interest in prehistoric history and have not visited Stonehenge before, I would definitely recommend travelling down to Wiltshire and going on a tour with the recorded audio described guide. Due to the size of the World Heritage Site, I would suggest sharing that experience with a sighted friend. Well, to find out more about Stonehenge and the recorded audio described guide, do visit english-heritage.org.uk/visit www.rnib.org/places/Stonehenge. Well, thank you so much for joining me here on RNIB Connect Radio for a cultural journey and the tour of Stonehenge with Liz and Scarlett.
For more interviews, features, and shows, go to your favourite podcast provider and search for RNIB Connect Radio.